It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Yes, it is. I now have my weekly chat with the Green Party co-leader. Today we spoke about the new quarantine fees for returning New Zealanders and also a new roadside drug testing bill. And lastly, the Greens' poverty action plan. The government has announced quarantine fees for returning New Zealanders coming back to Aotearoa from overseas last week. This is $3,100 per person in a room, with $950 for each additional adult and $475 for each additional child. The Greens have pushed for some exemptions to this. What exactly are these exemptions, and why were they important to secure for returning New Zealanders?
Well, the single most important exemption is that it's not retrospective. So in other words, it only applies to people who are leaving the country from this point forward, not people who have left previously, or people who are coming back for short trips, where we think that, you know, there's a sort of a reasonable case to say, well, you know, forearmed is forewarned. But there are literally tens of thousands of New Zealanders who are overseas, who were caught out by COVID, many of whom their work permits are coming to an end very shortly, and will essentially have to return home, and financial reasons being kind of first and foremost amongst those. So whilst we understand that quarantine is expensive to maintain, actually, that, you know, these people are part of the so-called team of 5 million. And this is just part of our public health response, which we have shelled out billions of dollars on supporting New Zealanders who are currently resident in New Zealand. We want to make sure that people, New Zealanders who are currently not resident but are coming home to reside, aren't caught out by that.
There's been criticism on both sides of this debate. Leader of the Opposition, Judith Collins, says that the fees won't create enough revenue to balance out the quarantine costs. Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters had similar concerns that the scheme wasn't fair on the taxpayer. And then, of course, on the other side of the equation, there are the New Zealanders overseas who, now with the introduction of such fees, don't know when they're going to be able to see their family, their mothers, fathers, children, brothers, sisters again. But the Greens' stance is that this is fair. Why was this option the best compromise?
Well, I mean, what it says, you know, for those people who are saying that they don't know when they're going to see their families again because of the cost involved, I mean, remember that this does, that they'll only get pinged if they're coming back for a short trip. So people who are coming to live here, you know, who are returning to New Zealand, won't have to pay that fee, and that is actually the vast majority of people. I think that if people sort of want to come back to New Zealand essentially for a holiday, then, you know, I think we have to recognise that there is a cost involved to the taxpayer of that. But the point is that you know, for fairness, and because it is actually one of New Zealanders' fundamental rights is the right to be able to return home, that actually for people who are sort of stuck in that situation and having to come back on a more permanent basis, they won't get charged. I think what we're saying, though, is, you know, I mean, we actually said right from the start that we should pay attention to our Bill of Rights here, which is that people have the right to return home. But there is a case to be made for people who are taking short-term trips out of the country or coming back into the country.
Let's move now to the roadside drug driver testing bill. This is a planned new law to give police the power to conduct random roadside drug testing of drivers. Aotearoa has quite shocking road crash and crash-related death statistics, and we already have roadside alcohol testing of drivers. How big of an issue is drug driving in New Zealand to necessitate the introduction of this law?
It's really big. Look, I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it is a very high portion of people who were in car accidents with alcohol were also discovered to have the presence of drugs. It's something almost one in two, I think, of people who tested positive for alcohol also tested positive for drugs of one form or another, usually pee or cannabis. And, of course, driving under the influence of drugs can have at least as much impact on a driver's ability as driving under the influence of alcohol. And so we feel it is really important that we're able to make sure that, you know, we can test for that and to make sure that people who are impaired are taken off the road.
Why do you think it's taken longer for drug driving to be addressed and seen as an issue?
I don't know. To me, it's a sort of an odd one in that, you know, like you say, we've had alcohol testing for a very long time. It does seem like a gap in the system that we haven't had driving for impairment under the influence of drugs. We haven't had a test for that, although, frankly, that could have something to do with the technology being available to be of much use. So the police have obviously been able to test for impairment for some time through sort of observed tests and so on. But what this does is allows for saliva testing, which is a scientific way of detecting what's actually in your bloodstream.
So under this law, drivers who test positive for the presence of drugs will be fined and then immediately suspended from driving for 12 hours and lose some demerit points. They would also face harsher criminal penalties where blood tests confirm impairing levels of drugs within their system or drugs combined with alcohol. Now that we're moving closer to the cannabis referendum, where there's the possibility of legalising that specific drug, would these penalties from the roadside drug testing change if the cannabis referendum is passed and it becomes legalised?
No, they wouldn't. I mean, you've got to remember, alcohol is currently legalised for consumption, but it's still illegal to drive under the influence of alcohol. This is exactly the same. So if the cannabis referendum passes and recreational cannabis use becomes legalised in New Zealand, it will still be illegal to drive under the influence of cannabis for exactly the same reason, which is that it makes you a worse driver and dramatically increases the chances that you will either injure or kill somebody else or yourself when you're behind the wheel.
So it's difficult to talk about police and power without acknowledging racism and racial biases within our forces, particularly with the current climate surrounding police power in the States and also around the world. Do you think introducing a bill that will give police more power will actually make people feel safer, or considering the social mood on police power, could it potentially make people feel more uneasy?
No, I think that for the most part, this will mean that people feel safer, because it is about taking drivers who are impaired under the influence of drugs off the road, right? And that is something that people know is a real problem. I don't think that you're going to solve the problem of racism and institutional bias within the police force via this law. That is a function of sort of institutional reform with the organisation itself. And I don't think that we should use that as an excuse not to ensure that we're making sure that people who are drug driving are no longer able to.
Now let's move lastly to the poverty action plan of the Greens. First, can you talk me through the guaranteed minimum income, which is one of the headlines that this plan outlines? What is it? How much is it? And who would be eligible?
Sure. So the idea behind the guaranteed minimum income is it is the total overhaul of the social safety net that, as we all know, has got so many holes in it that many, many people fall through it. The idea behind it is that there is a payment that is made to effectively anyone who needs it, which is, you know, unemployed people, maybe single parents who aren't in the workforce or have got limited opportunity to work, students is another big cohort, and so on. And the idea is that we would get rid of the kind of punitive and sanction-based system that we currently have and say, look, you know, when you need it, here is a payment. It's set at $325 a week, which is just shy of $100 north of the current unemployment benefit. There are top-ups, for example, for parents with children, to recognise the additional cost of raising children. And also there'd be some, additional support for people with disabilities with, you know, there's obviously a high cost of living there. And the idea there is we would be, in essence, implementing all of the recommendations of the Welfare Expert Advisory Group, and we'd be taking every family who's currently below the poverty line above the poverty line.
One other headline of the Poverty Action Plan is a 1% wealth tax for those who have a net worth of over $1 million. How is a wealth tax different from the tax that, say, myself or listeners who also may not have a net worth of over $1 million pay?
Yeah, don't.
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, okay, so this is how we pay for it, right? Because the guaranteed minimum income costs approximately $6 billion a year. To put it into context, the government spends about $100 billion a year, so it would be a 6% increase in government expenditure, and therefore you've got to get your revenue from somewhere. And a wealth so in New Zealand, we generally tax income through your work, a PAYE. We tax your consumption through goods and services tax, GST, and we have corporate tax as well. And there's some other bits and pieces, but those are our big three sources of revenue. And actually, one thing that we don't tax, which a lot of other countries do, is capital, or as you call it, wealth. And so the idea here is that about 6% of New Zealanders have a net worth of $1 million. And by net worth, you know, let's say, for the sake of argument, that you have a house that's valued at $1.2 million, but you have an $800,000 mortgage. Well, your net wealth is actually only $400,000, so you wouldn't pay the tax. So there's actually very few people who would have those houses and no mortgages on those houses, or a collection of other assets that would add up to north of $1 million. And what we're saying is that for people who do have a net wealth of over $1 million, each year we would ask them to contribute 1% of that, and that would easily cover the cost of the guaranteed minimum income.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.